Welcome to the Man Up, Man Down podcast, presented by Volker Baluda and David Pawsey. We discuss the pressures and challenges faced by men approaching middle age that we're often too embarrassed to speak about with our friends. You can find us online at www.manupdown.com. Enjoy the show and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review.
So welcome to another episode of Men Up, Men Down. On today's episode, we welcome Roderick Lambert, who helps busy midlifers lose weight forever and regain their metabolic health. It's a program for if you are 40 to 60 old, and you might find that you're struggling with overweight or obesity, or your doctor has started to warn you about cholesterol, blood pressure, diabetes, or insulin resistance. The joys of getting older, eh? Roderick struggled with obesity for 15 years himself until his doctor told him that he could have a heart attack within the next 5 years. After getting the usual advice of eat a little bit less, move more, and get a less stressful job, he decided to deep dive into nutrition and fitness. Roderick, before I tell the whole story, how you got to it, because we had a pre-talk as well, I signed up to your newsletter and I was just saying I'm really excited about the stuff you shared this week on social. First of all, welcome to the podcast, and we look really forward to understanding and hearing how you lost 20 kilos in 6 months and kept it off. I think that's a big bit. And B, I'm curious how I can shed 9 centimeters around my waist as well.
Well, I'm not saying anything.
Thank you, Volker. Thank you, David. Great to be here and great to be talking exclusively almost to the people I work with, that demographic that is exactly right up my street and where I am myself today. So how did I get here? Born in Britain, educated in Britain, left school, went to university, free life, started the usual kind of path into that took me into corporate HR for a big international banking group. And as is many of us experience, you leave school and you go to university, you start that free life when you're responsible for yourself. You enjoy life, and you know, whether it be going to the pub, late night curries, or whatever it might be, gaming to late at night. Well, that wasn't quite our thing so much in those days. You join a company, you start your career, office life, then you meet your partner or partners, depending on how many you get through before you find the right one. Then you might invest in your first property. You might have children. And you find yourself in your 30s already piling on the weight, which is simply an external sign of things that have been going on for a while. And you reach your 40s, 45, 50, and you get your first diagnosis. That's the doctor's ticking off your cholesterol. Then there's your blood pressure. Then it's things like uric acid and all these things. You start getting the pills. And unfortunately, once you start getting that first one, it's a slippery road. From that point on. And the only advice they'll give you about your lifestyle is simply eat less, move more, and get a less stressful job. The good news is that while all these symptoms are simply the incarnations of what's going on inside you at a cellular level and a subcellular level, you can actually do something about it and reverse all these conditions and actually regain energy, lose weight within, depending, you've been doing it for 2 decades, it's not going to take 2 months, but within 6 to 24 months, you can really get yourself back up to speed and looking and feeling really great. What happened to me simply was that I'd been through the sort of the typical yo-yo dieting, trying this thing, trying that thing, trying to take up jogging. At one point, I was even quite successful at it in my late 30s, but then got a new job, next big promotion, and all that ended, and I just rebounded to I think my maximum was about 95 kilograms for my 179 centimeters, and I had a huge belly. I had two kind of realizations a while back. I implemented them 5 years ago. One was that I didn't want to work in corporate anymore, or for a company. Creating shareholder value wasn't something that fulfilled me anymore. And the second thing was that I had to do something different about my health, because everything I read in the papers, the newspapers, and the magazines, online, in those days, or got information from the doctors, was that was simply eat less, move more. So I quit my job and trained as a coach. And I also, having a couple of years earlier discovered low carb, decided to implement what I'd learned and studied and done my own research on as well. And within 6 months, I dropped a little over 20 kilograms to my current weight. Since then, I've continued studying, researching, working out actually how it is the body works and what impacts the body, why it starts malfunctioning and you put on weight and things go wrong, and applying them to myself and the last 3.5 years to my clients who are particularly men in that midlife bracket who are in the same spot as I was. And that's where I am today.
Brilliant. I mean, 20 kilos. So first of all, thank you for that. I mean, 20 kilos in 6 months, that's a lot. I mean, I managed 10 kilos in about, 6 months. And I thought I was doing well.
Well, you were pushing the needle back, so you were doing well. What happened, though, afterwards?
It lasted for probably about a year and a half, and it slowly came back. And to be honest, and you know, maybe that's a longer form of a question for me to share my experience. So I'm, you know, obviously, if I say listeners can't necessarily see us, but so I'm quite tall, so I can hide a belly, not like David. So David is really short, and you know, he can't hide anything anyway. He can talk for himself and his Fat Friday football or whatever it is. So I'm quite tall, so I can hide it. So I can go up to about 100, 105, maybe 110 kilos without people noticing. But then when I dropped down, so that's a few years ago now, when I dropped down to about 90, 92 kilos, people almost go like, oh, you're looking ill, right? Because you start shedding weight and, you know, your cheeks kind of drop in and you get really slim. And what I find, I can keep it around 95 to 100 easily. So if I go a little bit over, you know, I just reduce a little bit of food I eat and, you know, but to really push it down to 90 or maybe even below 90 is, because it's not impossible because I can starve myself. So I'm a very disciplined person. I starve myself. But then you go back into the routine, right? So the kebab on a Friday night, you know, a couple of beers more. I like my red wine, you know, and we all know red wine, you know, it doesn't have any calories whatsoever, no sugar whatsoever, right? So
it's a health drink, isn't it? It's grapes.
It's good for your heart, right? As the doctor says, right? Look after your heart. I mean, how do you keep it up without really restricting yourself? I mean, do I have to live, you know, I deliberately say that, like a monk, right? Some bread, some water, although monks used to drink lots of ale, right? So
they did, and their mead and all that stuff. Monks typically, in you know, when you look at the character of a monk, is a rotund bald guy. So probably not your best
true
example for health advice. But how do you keep it up? Well, you feed your the first thing I'd like to say is it's not just about food and movement. That's two parts of the equation. But what food and movement do is they are impacting the your cells at a subcellular level, and very specifically in your mitochondria, which are these little organelles. You've got hundreds, even thousands of them in each single cell of your body, except for red blood cells, and they are responsible for signaling your environment and for energy metabolism and for antioxidant production and all sorts of stuff. So basically, this focus on just calories and movement and food and biochemistry is misguided. Because when you go to look at, and this is your question about the electrons, perhaps, it's about the easy passage of ample electrons in your mitochondria that creates something called ATP at the end of it. And that's what your cell uses for energy. When it's not getting enough ATP because there's not enough electrons coming through, or the little tiny nanomotors that are in this this mitochondrion get clogged up, then your cell starts to die. And there's a backup of substrate, energy or food, if you like, in your system that has to be stored somewhere, stored as fat. So if you're getting bigger, it's a sign that your mitochondria are starting to fail. If you're starting to get high blood pressure, if you're starting to have the early signs of heart disease, insulin resistance, or leading to diabetes, pre-diabetes, even your mood and is impaired, then this is all a sign that at the level of your cells, your mitochondria are starting to fail. Now, that was a bit too much, but so the currency of energy that we should be talking about, but we don't, is electrons. And when you see it through that frame, you realize that you get electrons from the things you eat. You stimulate and revive your mitochondria through exercise. But there is a whole series of other things where you can either get electrons or improve the function of your mitochondria, or rather prevent the damage of mitochondria. In three words, light, water, and magnetism. So you don't have to starve yourself. I do fast, but I do it for, let's say, therapeutic reasons, for the things that happen after about a 24, 36 hour fast. That's about cleaning up the side product, byproducts of metabolism, and about creating new cells in your body. But I do that a sort of a not very regular cadence. I don't go around hungry, because when you actually know what food does to your body, then actually you eat so that you don't get hungry and you're satiated for longer. I eat once to twice a day, and it's perfectly ample. I don't get hungry. I mean, my biggest feat so far in terms of, let's say, challenging myself was last summer. I did a 48-hour fast and I went marching in the hills each day 30 kilometers without a single calorie in that 48-hour period. And it was pretty much, apart from the certain, I was behind my knee, ligament soreness, I could have carried on fasting for longer. So the problem with the life we live, we've evolved for about, 500,000 years, Homo sapiens come along? About 70,000 years, but of course we've been evolving for at least 64 million years when we stopped being furry animals, furry underground mammals. We've evolved in an environment that is completely different to the one that we find ourselves now in the 21st century. And in particular, the last 150 years has completely changed the environment and the way that we live our lives. So we spend time indoors. We don't move. We look for convenience and comfort food. We're eating all the wrong food. All the recommendations are completely back to front. We don't expose ourselves to cold in winter. I'm talking to us Northern Europeans who are adapted for cold in winter. We don't get out in the sun, or if when we do, we put on cream and hats and sunglasses, preventing the actual spectra, the light from getting into our eyes, onto our skin, which are mitochondria absolutely need. So when you realize all this and you start taking action, then in fact, maintaining weight, putting on weight is a sign of things going wrong. When things are going right, you don't put on weight. So that's how I keep it going.
So how do you lose weight? That's the other question then, right? Because if you say, you know, when things go wrong, you put on weight, does that mean when things go right, you still need a calorie deficit, or how do you ensure you can lose weight? I mean, I suppose you lose weight if you go out hiking and don't eat for 48 hours, right?
Yes, you do. And then for sure, with one client, he did two 48-hour fasts in November and he dropped, he's towards the end of his journey, but he's already lost. By now, he's lost about 29 kilograms. But in November, he was frightened of plateauing, which happens. And that's, by the way, what happens often when you just do eat less, move more, is that it works for a bit and then you kind of get stuck, because you're not actually treating the root cause, which is the function of your mitochondria. So how do you lose weight? You focus on the composition of food. So you're eating stuff that actually enables your body to, gives your body the nutrients, micronutrients that it needs, and start working again. You look at the, but also it means you can eat less because you're satiated for more. You look at the timing of food. So, in what sort of period of time are you consuming calories, and how much of the time are you not consuming calories? If you think about our evolutionary pattern, it would have been feasting and fasting. So we would have be successful hunting the mammoth, we would have had food for, you know, a number of days, and then we might have gone quite a long time without nourishment.
Hello, it's Volker here. I hope you enjoy this episode. You might not realize that I have been coaching for almost a decade through both third parties and private clients. During that time, I have worked with brands such as General Electric, Imperial Brands, DHL and Pepsi. However, this year I'm putting a big emphasis on growing my private coaching practice, improving lives of middle-aged men in leadership positions. So if you hit midlife transition point and you might be a bit stuck or looking to improve your work-life balance, your career or productivity, you want to build a new habit, or you just want to become a better version of yourself, please hit me up. You can reach me on Volker@Obnatus, that's Volker@obnat.us, or LinkedIn, whatever is easiest. Thanks, and now back to the episode.
We now eat 24/7, of course.
Yeah, snacking. Sorry, David, I know you want to say something, but for me, a big problem is snacking in between meals, and I'm not snacking because I'm hungry. I'm snacking because, I don't know, I fancy something salty, something sweet, you know, I just fancy something different. And then, of course, you know, I mean, but once you open the mini eggs are out again, right, in time for you.
Easter already, bloody hell.
You know, a small bag of mini eggs, right? You can't just take one, right? You gotta eat the bag. Would be rude not to.
Well, that's what we're encouraged, you know, why have one, and the Pringles are so good you can't put them down, or whatever the slogan is. Exactly. Yeah, well, you know, you can look at the I'm going to give you, you know, a key tip that I always start all my clients on. Eat much more animal protein than you do currently. It's very, without looking at what you're doing currently, it's difficult to say, but yep. Very likely you're under-eating animal protein. First of all, there's a number of reasons why animal protein is really important. First of all, it's highly bioavailable. And we digest a very high absorbability by the body. Secondly, protein is the building block of pretty much everything that happens in the body. Thirdly, there's a thing called the protein leverage hypothesis. It's a hypothesis that they're demonstrating now in more and more research that we crave food until we've had enough protein. Once we've had enough protein, our brain doesn't get the signal to go and eat. Yeah, so that's probably the sort of the key kind of reasons why. And you need to get rid of something called leptin resistance. Leptin resistance is to do with a hormone that's generated by, basically it's a hormone that tells your brain how much energy you've got on board. But when you've got too much fat, then you've got too much leptin, and your receptors get resistant to the signal. So that when we're asleep and our brain does its kind of daily accountancy, it doesn't realize that it's got plenty of energy on board, and so the next day we're still hungry. But if you want to miraculously get rid of this emotional or eating, then go and have your first meal of the day. Make sure it's like mainly protein, a lot of it, and eat that first, the first thing on your plate.
Okay. So kebab for breakfast, without the bread, of course.
Kebab for breakfast. Kebab. Yeah. Well, why not? You know,
without the bread.
Kebabs are quite a handy thing when you're in town, because whenever you go somewhere, it's just rubbish on sale everywhere. But so sometimes a kebab is handy because it is meat and with a bit of, you know,
and salt
on the side. The only thing is, what is the origin of that meat and what's the quality?
That's the only problem, right? That's why I always think it's chicken cheese with salad without the pita bread is actually quite healthy, right? But yeah, you just don't know whether...
I don't know if healthy, but it's the best of a bad choice.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, David, you know, you want to get a word in as well, sorry.
Oh, that's all right. I've got lots of questions, so I'll try and not jump around too much. I mean, what you said about, you know, kind of how things have changed in society over the last 150 years, but you know, we're almost wired the same way that we've been for millennia. I wasn't even thinking about like today's podcast, but this week I sort of had a couple of random thoughts. One was, you know, when did we start eating three meals a day? You know, and when did that become the standard? And also, you know, what are there many cultural differences in terms of, you know, I mean, like, because in Western society, which, you know, is a bit of a generalization, but it's, you know, either cereal for breakfast or, you know, eggs and bacon. And then you got lunch and then you got dinner. And it is, well, you eat because it's time to eat, as opposed to what you've described as because your body needs it. Yeah, do you sort of, well, are there many cultural differences, and, you know, is there any kind of logic to the reason for us to eating three meals a day?
There totally is, absolutely. I wouldn't call it necessarily Western style, I call it industrialized society, because
right,
the same
yeah.
thing is, happens wherever the societies become, take on this our industrialized society pattern, the same things happen. You look at the massive increase in diabetes in China or India. They've gone from rural to highly industrialized, today, technological societies, and the whole population is suffering as a result. You can trace it back to about, you know, 10,000 years ago, roughly, when there was the so-called agricultural revolution, when we learned how to breed animals and grow crops, and we could settle down more. We didn't have to be so mobile. We'd have more stable food supply. So that's perhaps the first kind of milestone. Then you can look fast forward to the Industrial Revolution, where people moved from the countryside, where, you know, you're outdoors most of the time, you were getting up with the sunrise, you were physically active, you were eating, you know, lots of animal products and whatever grew in your backyard, and you maybe ate only twice a day, to the cities where, you know, the factories needed laborers, and the laborers had to work, you know, in shifts, and you needed to feed those laborers. So what do? You produce bread and you know, based on grains, which are fairly easy to grow and quite easy to process and produce a large amount of calories, but not nutrients, to keep your workforce not healthy, but to keep them going.
Productive,
Yeah, productive. And then 40, 50 years ago, electrification happened. So we ended up, you know, with houses full of AC currents. 50 years ago, you know, we discovered things like fluorescent lighting. 20 years ago, LEDs came in. Then all these digital devices. So we're filling our air with non-native electromagnetic frequency. We're living indoors 95% of the time, not out in the daylight. We're because of artificial light, we're able to stay awake for longer and be productive. So the I think it's all about the trend of productivity is what makes us ill. Unfortunately, it also decreases our productivity, because we spend more sick days, worse mood, less energy, more health issues. So it's kind of ironic.
The other question I had was sort of just around fasting. I mean, you sort of mentioned there that so you personally haven't gone longer than 48 hours.
No. And this year is my next challenge, is to go I don't know, 5 days, for instance.
Right. I don't know if you've seen the, there was a TV series on National Geographic. It's one of the Hemsworth brothers. I think it was Chris Hemsworth, the guy that plays Thor. Basically, he kind of put himself through all the sort of, I don't want to say physical challenges, but it was all about increasing, you know, his longevity. One of the episodes was dedicated to fasting, and I can't remember. I think he went 4 or 5 days. But I mean, is there sort of an optimum amount of time, and sort of what are the risks, and, you know, what are the benefits, sort of not by an hour by hour basis, but, you know, what is the benefit of a 24-hour fast versus a 48-hour fast?
There's a kind of small fast, really. I mean, in the end, I mean, once generally, I talked about the second thing I'd go with clients is the timing of food. So we eat for too many hours of the day. We also eat out of sync with the circadian daily circadian rhythm of our cells. The second thing we do is we shorten the window in which you consume calories. You know, you might have heard of intermittent fasting or time restricted eating. The point about that is that as soon as you put any food into your mouth, doesn't matter if it's a snack or a big meal, you ramp up certain processes in your body that are demanding. Plus, the actual digestion and metabolism of food creates a whole bunch of byproducts that that need to be dealt with. So if you're continually eating, you never have that rest and digest time. You're always in this active mode of metabolizing food. So when you reduce that to, well, let's say maximum 12 hours, ideally, let's say 10, apparently the sweet spot is about 8 hours, then you're giving your body 16 hours to deal with all that. when you go to like longer fast, so 24, well, longer, when you extend it, then things start to happen. I'll go through in a second what, but one thing to your listeners I'd point out is that if you're on a high carbohydrate standard Western kind of pattern diet, then your ability to access your own body fat as a source of fuel is going to be, let's say, rusty. Before you start fasting, you need to reactivate your ability to switch between glucose metabolism and fat metabolism. I mean, there's a reason we have glucose and free fatty acids in our blood. There's a reason we store fat. It's for energy in lean times, and we are physiologically, in fact, babies are born burning fat. In fact, they're in ketosis for up to like 8 years of their life. That's why babies are fat when they're born, because their stomachs are too small to consume enough foods. Yeah, so they use the body fat for everything from, of course, energy supply, but also, you know, heat production, etc. They don't have a thermodynamic system that we have as adults. They create brown fat from their white fat to create heat. So it's absolutely normal to burn fat. It should be, I call it the diesel. I call it our standard long-distance fuel. Your glucose essentially is for your fight or flight, running away from the big animal that's going to kill me. That's when you need your glucose. But we have plenty of glucose in us for that, stored in our liver, stored in our muscles. Unfortunately, we've turned into these kind of combustion engines that just run on high octane glucose, and that causes a lot of problems. So when you extend, but once you get to the point where you can, you know, that 16:8 or whatever the time restricted fasting pattern that you start doing. Once you get used to that, then you can start, extending that gradually to, let's say, 24 hours to 36 hours, 48 hours. And what happens is that after a period of time without eating, your body switches into a different mode. So the first thing that happens is something called autophagy, which is literally from the Greek, eat yourself. It happens, actually should happen, if you're metabolically healthy, every night for a few hours. You burn fat for fuel. Autophagy is eating yourself. It's burning up or eating up, disposing of all the exhaust and litter that your body has created during the day. Because day and awake and sleep are two very different modes. And sleep is there for a reason, very different to the reasons we are awake. And lots of different things happen during the day, and then other different things happen during the night to clear up that mess. You don't want the mess around, because that's when you start getting inflammation and cell reproduction gets out of control, turns into cancer, etc. So you need to clean up the mess, and autophagy is something that should happen every night, but for a lot of people won't, because they're not sleeping enough, or they're simply not insulin sensitive and able to burn fat. So that's one thing that happens. Then a bit later on down the line, you get things like apoptosis, which is the programmed cell death. Our cells, cells are being replenished on a daily basis, depending on what type of cell it is. It may not be daily, might be monthly, might be weekly, whatever. The periods are different. But if they don't get the signal to say, bye-bye, come and clear me out, I'm dead, then they stay there, they linger, and that creates inflammation and all these cancers and that sort of stuff. So apoptosis, again, is something that should be normal, but because of the way we lead our lives, doesn't happen as thoroughly as it should. So if you put in a 24, 36, 48-hour fast, depending on your health status, when you do all this, you will set off this process of cleaning out all the kind of defunct or dying cells and replacing them with new ones. As soon as like 36 hours, roughly, you start getting new stem cells produced. Stem cells are, you know, the ones that haven't yet been programmed to do a function. They're produced, and they're, then your body says, okay, you're going to be a liver cell, you're going to be a heart cell, you're going to be a hair cell or whatever, and you get new cells. So in fact, it's like regenerating. You're actually becoming younger if you can do that. So that's a number of things, the benefits of doing longer fast.
Sorry, I'm just going to ask one more question, then I'll let Volker get back in.
I'm eager. That's so much to learn.
You sort of mentioned, well, you know, sort of the phrase, how we live our lives is impacting, you know, the body's ability to carry out the process you've just described. Is that the things that we eat, or is that the times that we eat? I mean, I'm a terrible sort of snacker in the evening, so I will eat often an hour before I go to bed. Whereas like today, you know, and I'd say this is relatively typical, I haven't eaten yet. You know, my first food will be, well, you know, around 1 o'clock. I mean, like in relation to when you're asleep and when you fast, or, well, yeah, is that the impact, or would it be what I've eaten before I've gone to bed?
All those things, plus the light you shine on yourself during the day, the light you have on at home, the devices we're talking on, the temperature that we have pretty much temperate all year round, etc. So it's all these things. So to go to directly to your point, though, yeah, it's what you're eating, it's when you're eating. If you eat the right stuff, then you won't feel the need to snack. Certainly, you want to be eating much earlier than 1 hour before you go to bed, for the simple reason that, as I said, it takes like 4 to 8 hours for your body to deal with what you've put into it. So if you're going to bed with that, those processes going on, which is an active process, let's call it, or a waking process, then you're not going to sleep well, and it's going to impact all the things that are supposed to happen while you're asleep. You said, you know, it's 1 o'clock or in the UK almost. So, you know, that's my kind of, was my regular model, not eat till roughly lunchtime. In the winter, though, I discovered it's actually more beneficial, and probably overall it's better beneficial to have your first meal in the morning once the sun's come up, and then have a second meal at some point later in the day when you're hungry. You talked about earlier, you know, it's breakfast morning, we have breakfast, it's lunchtime, we have lunch, it's dinner time, we eat by the clock. But actually, one of the, I've got these 14 rules of golden rules of fat loss, Volker, I think you're getting. So one of those golden rules is only eat when hungry, which of course is difficult to fit in because you're at the office today, David. So, you know, everybody gets up at, I don't know, 12 o'clock, goes off to have some lunch. So you go with them. So you have to find a way how to combine that with what a wife said.
Man Up, Man Down is sponsored by Well-Doing. As someone who has seen a counsellor for a number of years, I think their approach is great. They want you to find the mental health professional who is right for you. You can filter your search to highlight therapists with expertise where you need it, or you can pay to use their personalised matching service. The people who run Well-Doing are experts in mental well-being, and they also have loads of posts and interviews to keep your mental health in good shape. Take a look at welldoing.org.
One thing I wanted to say, because I missed this opportunity earlier, you know, like a fat monk, I have bad habits. Right. Anyway, back to you, Volker.
Did you say you look like a fat monk, or did I miss?
No. Yeah, that. Well, I do look like a fat monk.
But... It's a dad joke, Volker. It's a dad joke.
So many questions. As you say, right? I'm getting your newsletter and stuff as well. But so it's a whole fasting thing. So I'm trying to get my head around now what I need to do, because I stop eating at 9 o'clock at night. I don't eat until usually one-ish the next day. I take my supplements in the morning, but I always skip breakfast because it's easy to skip. Then I have a huge breakfast, right? I mean, breakfast, lunch, right? So, but I'm not losing any weight, right? So I know friends of mine, they go like, oh yeah, I do this intermittent fasting thing, you know, 16-8. And they just drop 2 or 3 kilos, 4 kilos, 6 kilos, you know? And I'm like, I don't. Should I stop? Should I go back to my breakfast and my fry ups? And
without knowing more, it'd be quite difficult to say exactly. It'll spend, you know, it depends on what you're eating as well. And as I've said, you know, one thing, One thing in winter you might like to try is going back to your, if, especially if you know you don't have an office clock to live by, then is have a substantial breakfast. I don't know what time the sun comes up in the UK right now. It's probably it's about 7 o'clock. No, I didn't say when you can see the sun. Otherwise, you know, you'll never eat them. But when the light, you know, light comes and the sun is up, it's about 7:30 in this part of the world anyway. Yeah, this time of year. Then have a substantial breakfast of protein and fat. Go out and see, get yourself into the daylight first thing. Absolutely important. It resets your body's master clock and therefore all the clocks in your cells. Then have your day. If you can get out as well, go for a 20-minute walk or something.
Yeah.
At this time of year, there's very weak or even no UV light, so it's not that important. But in the summer, it's really important to get out also for that UV light. And then in the evening at sunset at 3:30, 4 o'clock, whatever time it is, ideally you would also get out so you can get that signal that the day is coming to a close. And have your second meal, ideally, you know, around 4 or 5 p.m. And then after sunset, either switch off your lights, totally impractical, light up your house with candles and lanterns, bit dangerous perhaps, or get yourself these bulbs that actually have no blue in them, no blue and green, or glasses, a bit like these. These yellow ones are 70% blocking for during the day when I'm looking at screens or under artificial modern lighting. But after about 7 p.m., not quite after sunset, it's a bit later, but after about 7 p.m., I put on these red ones that are 100% blocking blue and green, because light is a signal. I mean, light isn't just a signal. Light is much more than that, but light is a signal. And depending on the spectrum of the light, which means the visible and non-visible, which you get from the sun, to the stuff you get indoors, which is mainly peaked at blue and blue light. Blue light is strongest at midday. In the evening, you're telling your brain that it's midday. Not surprising that hormonal cascade that goes around on a 25-hour cycle is completely out of sync. And that's one of the, all these things I mentioned will help you actually get that clock ticking properly. And then your cells will start working properly, and then you'll start to perhaps, you know, lose weight.
Interesting. So I need to read that, because what I find difficult from what you just said is, so if I didn't miss seeing you, you skip literally lunch and you don't eat until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then you don't have a dinner until, or you don't have dinner, right? So you eat early in the morning and then you eat.
That's kind of an optimal. I'm talking about an optimal regime.
Yeah.
It's like at about 7:30, 8 o'clock, have a substantial breakfast and then a second meal later on in the day at some point. But of course, we have families, we have jobs.
Yeah.
And so you have to find a way that's going to work. But you definitely don't want to be eating later than 3 hours before you go to bed.
Yeah.
And you definitely want to be ideally eliminating the amount of blue-rich light hitting your skin and going to your eyes after sunset.
So yeah, we interviewed a sleep expert, and this is something that I'd learnt about before, but how, well, I guess, you know, I sort of thought, right, I need to make sure that I can get as much sunlight as I can during the day, and then I'll sleep better at night. I mean, I didn't actually realise that, you know, there's a digestive or, you know, like a metabolic sort of aspect to that as well. I mean, again, this is a thought that I had when I went out. Well, as you say, because this time of year, you know, there isn't as much sun, and you know, I find that it affects my mood. I try and get out for a walk every day, and I went out the other day, and I sort of had my coat on, I had a hat on, and I was like, well, actually, how much sun am I actual daylight am I actually getting? You know, I'm like, well, if it was summer, I'd be out in my shorts and my t-shirt. Whereas, you know, I'm like, how much benefit am I getting? So can you sort of just talk about that? Whether, you know, is it literally the amount of skin I've got on show? Is, you know, is that how much sun I attract? So, you know.
Ultimately, yes.
So the less skin you have on show, David, the better it is. I can tell you that already.
Well, perhaps for your environment, but for you, the more you've got out, the better, for sure.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, in winter, it's a bit different to the summer. But in winter, cold is a much more stronger circadian input. But nevertheless, it's not just your skin, it's your eyes. The light that comes into your eyes. You have visible light receptors, but you have also non-visible light receptors. We need one, the ones you have for vision, and then you have these non-ganglion receptors that pick up light, but you're not seeing an image in your brain. They react to the type of light you're getting, and they monitor the changing spectrum, strength, wavelength of light, and of course, as UV comes and goes during the day, they monitor what's going on. So does your skin. And the ones in your eyes are directly connected to what's called the SCN, the suprachiasmatic nucleus that's in your hypothalamus. And that's your master clock. So basically, they're sending signals directly to your master clock about what time of day it is, what season it is. And based on that, sending signals to your pituitary gland. They're sending, you know, internally signals to all your cells, which have their own clocks, and they're setting them. So if the best thing you can do in terms of getting out, even in winter, is get out in the morning, in that early morning sun, because that's going to reset your clock every day. And the more consistently you can do that, the better the effect will be. So yes, ideally you'd be going out there in your shorts, shirtless, on that freezing field, wherever it might be. But let's face it. Well, actually, if you did that, it'd be great, because it's also you're getting some of that cold effect as well. But
As I messaged Volker the other day when I went out for a walk, because we've had a lot of snow. Well, I actually got my phone out to write a message to Volker and immediately slipped over and got covered in mud. But anyway, that's a completely irrelevant anecdote. You sort of talked about fasting and hiking. I mean, sort of, I said to someone over Christmas, I'm like, oh, my new year is going to involve a lot of fasted, like, cycling. I mean, obviously you've said it's not necessarily about calories in and calories expended, but I mean, what is sort of a, you know, exercising a low aerobic long exercise in a fasted state, is that, I say, better, but is that more likely to generate weight loss than high intensity stuff, or is it you got to mix it up?
Let's put aside the fastest day first of all.
Okay,
keep that separate. Yeah, one thing that a lot of people do is they get on that treadmill and they pound away for half an hour at a higher heart rate. If your goal is losing fat, then that's going to be detrimental. Low intensity, steady state is the way to go. And that means that you're keeping your heart rate below a certain level called the lactate threshold. So it's when your body is able to deal with the lactates being produced and it's not overcome by lactate and you don't start going into the anaerobic process of glucose burning overall, even fat. When you stop burning fat, you start burning more glucose. We're burning both fuels at the same time, just in different proportions, depending on how fast our cells need for the respiration during exercise. So there's a guy called Philip Maffetone. By all means, look him up. He's great. He's big on this. He's still a trainer, trainer of athletes, sportsmen, women. And you will notice that even elite sportsmen do a lot of low intensity, steady state exercise off season, because it actually, in the end, it helps build up their VO2, their lactate threshold. It actually pushes it higher. And the higher you can push your lactate threshold, the more endurance you're going to have when you actually go into your race. For us, that's irrelevant. What you need to know is that if you stick below a certain level of heart rate, then you won't be getting beyond that lactate threshold. And in fact, first time I came across this, I did an experiment. I just went jogging, monitoring my heart rate below, for me, it was about 127 beats per minute. The experiment was just to see how long I could go. And after about 2 hours and 15 minutes, I stopped because I was bored, mindlessly bored, going around the circuit, and my phone battery was running out, so I'd run out of music. So, but I didn't feel tired at all. I felt I could have carried on forever. knowing and what's you and you know and know that when you do that, you're actually with taking out of your bloodstream fatty acids, and of course you're using glucose, and both of those things require body to replenish the levels. And where's it going to take it? It's going to take it from your fat stores. To the fasting point, I don't know exactly. I don't think the scientific literature has identified whether or not it's more beneficial in a faster state or in a fed state. So, you know, I find I do exercise with more pleasure, and that's really important, when I'm in the faster state. But that's my personal experience. But the key thing is, if fat burn is your goal, keep below your lactate threshold.
Warwick, we could carry on and on. I have so many more questions.
Well, I take 3 months with my clients getting through all this. So, you know, it's a...
Yeah. So I think what I suggest to all the listeners, first of all, is to add to my questions I still have, right? And maybe we collect a few questions and get you back for round two. There's so much to find out, because it's not as easy as, you know, I thought.
It's not as easy as calories in, calories out, no.
Exactly. So, you know, I don't eat. I go to the gym in the morning and everything else, right? But it's a cheese and the wine. That's what it is, really. But a highly fascinating topic as well, and I think so relevant, right? I mean, if we look at obesity rates, and, you know, say not only in this country, in the UK, you know, if I always say, you know, I lived in Scotland for a while, I think the child obesity rate in Scotland is higher now than the child obesity rate in the States. So if that's still the case or not, fact check it somewhere else. But
you're going to get sued by Scotland for making such outrageous accusations.
It's a fried Mars bars, right? Although they're high in fat, right? And we think we need to have a high fat, low carb diet. But anyway, I love that country, by the way. That's a disclaimer. But no, we see so many people, unfortunately, that are overweight and can't keep it off. And as I say, I can hide it. You know, I don't have to join the fat football club, which we haven't talked about in this episode at all.
Just to explain to Roderick, I play football on a Friday, but it's man versus fat football. So you have to be a certain level of, you have to have a certain BMI to be able to play. But yeah, it's my first one of the year tonight, so I'll be getting on the scales and seeing all the damage from Christmas. So, but I'll certainly be putting all... and actually, I've got myself booked in for a health check next Wednesday, so I'll be getting all my cholesterol and everything. So maybe, with all that data, we could come back to see how long I've got to live.
Very happy, you know. Answer any specific questions, we can have a look at your data. That's also something I do with clients, is, you know, look at that
would be interesting.
And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, on the notes of clients, you know, shameless plug obviously for you as well, but, you know, if someone wants to join your fortune program, where can they find out more? I mean, I get the newsletter, and you know, I'm always that close to signing up, but I'm like, you know, we talk about that offline. Okay. But what's the best way to get in touch, Roderick?
Yep, absolutely. So my sort of links page is called midlifemetabolichealth.com. It's all one word, yeah. midlifemetabolichealth.com. There's a whole bunch of like free stuff there and client testimonies and that sort of thing. So go and have a look there. And I'm most active on LinkedIn, where I post almost daily stuff around all this. I see it as kind of a way of getting out the message, getting tips as well. Of course, it's also for business, drumming up business. But so those two places. And if you want to email me directly, it's very simple. It's roderick@midlifemetabolichealth.com.
Brilliant. And we put all that in the show notes as well. And thank you so much for your time. That was so insightful. As I say, we always often say that we need to get someone back for round two, but I think, yeah, there's lots more questions we need to ask you. Thank you so much.
I'll be happy to ask, and thank you for the invitation.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. Feel free to reach out to Volker or David via our website, www.manupdown.com, or podcast@manupdown.com, with any feedback or to let us know what topics you'd like us to cover in the future. Hear you again soon.